Now it dealt with the affair of a bishop who has denied the Holocaust. In his unprecedented letter, the Pope expresses regret that what he calls a gesture of mercy to Bishop Richard Williamson was overshadowed by the controversy over Williamson's views. The Pope lifted the excommunication of Williamson along with three other bishops, and then the Vatican claimed it was not aware of Williamson's positions on the Holocaust, which had been circulating widely on the Internet. In his letter, the Pope says he's learned to be more attentive to the Internet, and he says he feels deep pain over hostility that some Catholics have directed at him. He also warns that the Church risks, quote, biting and devouring itself through internal disagreements. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from GM, dedicated to green technologies, including hydrogen-powered cars. Details at gm.com/solutions.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta is now open in their new location at Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the music business and about how the big players in the business failed to understand and take advantage of emerging digital technologies. And our guest for the program is Steve Knopper. We'll be talking about his book, Appetite for Self-Destruction. The subtitle is The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age. It's published by the Free Press. In the book, he observes that at one time, the music business was arguably one of the most glamorous, one of the most high-profile industries in the world. But now that has changed, he says, because the big players in the music world spent too many years in denial as technology changed dramatically. Today, he says, the major labels are in danger of becoming obsolete. Our guest, Steve Knopper, is a Rolling Stone contributing editor. He's covered the music business since 2002. He's also written for publications including Wired, Esquire, Entertainment Weekly, Chicago Tribune, and Details. He's also written and edited four books, including The Complete Idiot's Guide to Starting a Band and Moon, Colorado. He makes his home in Denver. Mr. Knopper, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Well, thanks very much for being with us. I think it's a lot of really interesting stuff in this book, and if someone is interested in the music business and the personalities, it's there. And I think also, though, if somebody, I guess, if they just wanted the, you know, the Cliff's Notes version of what happened to the business, I think they could do very well simply by reading your list of the eight big mistakes that big music made, and we can try to talk about some of those things. What we're talking about here essentially is the coming of the digital age, beginning with CDs, compact discs. But maybe just for a minute, I would ask you to start and to, you know, talk a little bit about what was going on in the music business right on the eve of the arrival of the compact disc.
Sure, absolutely, and that's exactly where my book begins. Basically, in 1979, the record industry, meaning the big record labels, had just undergone a pretty hard time. They were in a recession. Disco had basically just crashed, and people were returning their records because they were tired of disco, and all the disco records that were in the stores, people just weren't buying them, and so the stores were returning them. And through a series of events, some hanky-panky going on at various record labels such as Casablanca, which was somewhat infamous, the industry kind of crashed. It went through a really hard time. And it wasn't until really Michael Jackson's Thriller, until about 1982, and then MTV, and then the adoption of the compact disc that really set things right again. And the compact disc in particular set things very, very right, and the industry went through this huge boom that would last for more than 15 years, beginning in the early 80s.
And the interesting, there's a lot of interesting facets to that because, as you say, eventually for the industry, the CD was really good. They sold lots of CDs and they made a lot of money, but initially, no one except the people who had developed the technology, they were excited about it, but nobody else, the record companies didn't like it, the artists didn't like it, and the music retailers didn't like it. Now, I guess they all found their reasons to come around, but right initially, all of those people associated with the business of making and selling music, nobody liked CDs.
Right. There's a large resistance in the record industry community among executives, and there were actual conferences where industry conferences where Philips and Sony, the inventors and the manufacturers of the CD, would go and present the CD and say, "Yeah, everybody adopt this." And they would, people who were heads of record labels at the time actually would scream at them at these meetings and say their main argument was that they thought that the CDs would enable piracy. They thought that with an album that was so pristine that people could make copies over and over and over again, clear, easy copies on tape, this would just allow these gigantic bootlegging rings. And so they opposed it for that reason. But there are other reasons too. For example, if you change over from vinyl record plants around the world that are manufacturing literally millions of records, you shut all those down and then all of a sudden build new ones for CDs that are clean room, high-tech plants, suddenly you're talking about expenditures of something like $10 million per plant. And that was something that was a little bit too difficult to fathom for some of the executives who were doing pretty well.
Yeah. And it seems like what ultimately, though, as far as the record companies were concerned, that turned them around was they realized that people would buy them. They realized, they started thinking, hey, you know what we could do? We could take our whole analog catalogs and reissue them as CDs, and people will go out and buy them. And on top of all of that, they realized that people were willing to buy CDs even though they were priced significantly higher than vinyl LPs.
Yes, exactly. All three of those factors were true. In short, the executives smelled the money. But there's one other factor, too, which is that behind the scenes, as artist managers ruefully recollect today and who I interviewed for the book, the CD enabled labels to go back to many of a large number of their artists and say, let's rejigger these contracts. And they would sneak in, you know, new packaging deductions and new technology deductions and stuff like that. And they could kind of goose the royalty rate on CDs in a little bit more favorable way, whereas the LP contracts and deals were sort of well-established after many years.
Mm. Also, at the beginning, there were some musical artists who really spoke out against digital. What they were really talking about was digital recording technology and what that did to the sound. And still today, I'm sure there are people who say, who have bad things to say about digital as compared to analog. And one of the people you mentioned in the book who was really leading this charge against the digital recording and the CD was Neil Young.
Right.
But then also what the companies did was they started to woo the performers and show them what it sounded like. And apparently enough people came around. So, and of course now it's just what everybody does. Generally speaking, do people who make music, musicians, have they made their peace with digital recording technologies?
For the most part. I mean, I think that there's always a contingent out there who will say, you know, the CD doesn't have quite the warm, thick, rich sound of an LP. And I think that makes sense. I guess my response to that, I sort of come out in the book and say I think CDs are better quality, and I've gotten some heat for that. But my feeling is, yes, in a vacuum, an LP has a little bit richer sound than a CD, but LPs scratch and pop and warp so much that it's very difficult to get those vacuum conditions. And so CDs are much easier to maintain. You can scratch them, but not if you're careful. So I think that, you know, there definitely are still people who say it's really a shame that we had to switch to the CD. But at the time, I really think the greater voice that we were hearing was that it was just scary. You know, when you shift over from the old kind of old school studio techniques with old technology to digital recording, suddenly everybody could hear all the little things that went on in the studio. You know, you could hear air conditioners running with this new digital technology. You could hear people moving chairs around and people's shoes squeaking on the floor. And a couple of jazz albums actually came out that way, and they scared the heck out of certain musicians. They didn't want that on their records. Mm. But, of course, you know, people learned how to adapt, and now, you're right, digital music is pretty much the standard of recording these days.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Steve Knopper. He is a Rolling Stone contributing editor. He's the author of the book Appetite for Self-Destruction, about the record industry and how it really failed to come to grips with, understand, take advantage of digital technology. His book's published by Free Press. We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation, so we'll do that, starting with someone in Chicago on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm glad that they stopped suing people who downloaded music, because I always thought that was bad public relations. And I, one of the things I wanted to comment on before I ask my question was, isn't it true about the time digital came along that someone invented something called a laser turntable, where you could put your LP in and it wouldn't, you didn't have to keep it under the needle and it could make it last longer? And also, do you think the day will come when there will be no more record stores, that if you want your music, you'll just go to your computer? If you hear something you like on the radio, even if it's at 3 o'clock in the morning, you'll be able to download it right onto your hard drive.
I think we're already there.
Oh.
Or almost. Well, Steve, what do you think?
Let's see. I'll start with the last question first. You know, I don't think record stores are ever going to completely go away, but certainly there are much fewer of them than there were even 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, Tower Records just closed down, I think, late 2006, and that was pretty recently, and things have changed a lot since then. Walmart and Best Buy, which are still major music retailers, have been drastically cutting their shelf space. So, yes, it's obviously going in the direction that the caller suggests. But, you know, there are kind of niche record stores. Here in Denver, we have Twist and Shout. In L.A. and other cities, there's Amoeba Music. You know, every city seems to have one sort of stalwart record store that caters to the customer and knows the customer and has clerks who are friendly. And I think that there will always be a niche for those people. But you're right. I think it's for the mass of consumers, we're starting to see a shift to it's much easier to buy your record on Amazon or download it digitally from either Amazon or the iTunes store.
Yeah, and it isn't just records. It's everything else. It's movies and it's books.
Yep, I think so. I think it's going in the direction of consumer convenience.
Which pretty soon it won't take 2 hours to download a movie. It'll take about 30 seconds.
Yep, that's correct. I think that's true. And it's going in that direction for sure. And you know, it's good for the consumers, I think, ultimately. You have a lot more choice.
Yeah.
Not so good for the companies who make their money off of the high profit margin CDs or DVDs or going to the movies or whatever it is.
And now what about this other thing? Did you hear about this laser turntable I mentioned?
You know, I'm not familiar with that particular technology. Are you talking about something that was out in the early 80s? When
it came out just before the CD craze came along.
I personally do not remember that.
I think it was at the CES in Las Vegas. Of course, a lot of stuff comes out there that never makes it onto the consumer market. But
yeah,
I believe they said you can put your LP in there, and you didn't have to have a needle, and it would run that way, and it would make it last longer, and of course you could bump it, and it wouldn't jump or scratch or go ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of that, but I imagine that the CD, which also uses the same kind of laser technology to read the disc, I would imagine it just sort of made that technology either obsolete or
yeah, it's too bad it couldn't have come out 10 years earlier. Otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much.
Right, thank you for calling.
We'll talk next with someone in the not-too-far-away community of Belgium. Here, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, sirs. Mm-hmm. I'd like to point out several exceptions to your discussion. Number one, here in Danville, there is a small record store. Not only he's not making $1 million, he's hanging on, and he's been doing it for many, many years. And he has a loyal and faithful clientele that just keep coming back to him and coming back to him. He handles CDs and DVDs and all those sort of things, but has a lot of LPs too. But otherwise than that, I would like to talk to you back towards the people who put out the music, I guess the labels. My son works for a label in San Francisco, and a very, very close friend of mine has a label there in Champaign, both of which I don't know that they're never going to compete with the big boys, but they definitely seem to be doing okay. The one in San Francisco is Fat Records, which I'm sure you may have heard of. I don't know as much about them, but the one in Champaign started in mid-90s, just about the time the digital situation started, and he's just kept moving along with it, and seems to be doing quite well.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I didn't mean to say that there are no labels or record stores that are doing well right now. In fact, you know, just to address your record store comment, as I mentioned, Twist and Shout in Denver here and Waterloo in Austin, there's a lot of different small record stores that are hanging on because they are good record stores. People still want the consumer experience. You know, I think that those kinds of stores will hang on for a long time. I think that they're doing well. But, you know, the idea that everybody is going to buy records and it's this mass phenomenon that hundreds of millions of people buy CDs and that's the way everybody makes their money in the industry, I think that whole idea is extinct. And as far as your discussion about the small labels, a lot of small labels are doing well in this environment, and mostly because they don't have the huge overheads of the major record labels like the Warners and the Sony BMGs of the world. You know, in my book, I mention a few of those small ones like Wind Up or Merge Records in North Carolina, these indie labels that have really low, you know, they're lean and mean, as they say. They have small staffs, and they can afford to experiment and tinker. And not only that, but they put out albums that have a very loyal fan following. And so when an artist on those labels says, you know, we make money off of you buying our CDs, so could you please buy that? And in addition, we'll give you a few free songs through our record, through our website or whatever. You know, fans are loyal enough to do that. When you get to the bigger level and the mass artist, it's harder to get that kind of overwhelming fan loyalty sometimes.
I noticed in the case of the album There in Champagne, which is Polyvinyl, they seem to really cater to the artist, too. In other words, the artist comes out and they want to... One of their groups is Of Montreal. And Of Montreal is from Georgia and has nothing to do with Montreal, which I don't understand. But anyway, they put out albums that have a lot of very specialized print liners and stuff like that, and, you know, over the top. And I think that's probably where they add value that way.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, Of Montreal is a great band, and I actually got their CD, and it does have really interesting packaging and cover art. And so that's definitely one way of doing it, for sure. There are many artists out there and many labels and record stores who are surviving under that old system. But I do think that those are small deals, and I think that the bulk of the record industry and the music industry is shifting to digital. And, you know, I think that's positive. I think it's good and it's convenient for consumers, and I think it's the way of the future. And I you know, I think it'd be a mistake to say, let's look at these small examples and say, therefore, that's the way of the future. I still think those small examples they represent more of the niche, and the mass going forward is going to be shifting to digital. I think the numbers clearly show that.
Yeah, but it seems like as you've discussed here, really the difference is between what are your expectations? How many units do you think you're going to sell? How much money do you want to make? How high profile, what sort of audience would you be satisfied having? And there's a big difference between people who have platinum expectations and those people who think they would feel happy if they might sell a few thousand.
I think just in this world right now, the mold is broken open, and I think that's a really good thing. I mean, 20 years ago, if you were Of Montreal, really the only way that you could sell a certain number of records to even have a career would be to have a sizable major label that's attached to you, with some rare exceptions. It didn't have to necessarily be a major label, but it had to be an established independent label that had a strong distribution system, somebody who was able to get all those crates and warehouses and records and record stores all lined up, and somebody who had access to the radio waves. And today, yes, there are many artists, such as Of Montreal and such as others, who still do it that way, and that's fine. There will probably always be room for that. But the mold is broken. There are many, many other ways that you can get your music out there without having those resources. MySpace, YouTube, your own website, all these different things. And so, therefore, I think there's much more power to the artist and to the artist representative, like the manager or the agent, than there ever was. And I think that's positive.
All right. I want to thank the caller. Go on to another. This is Line 2, Champagne. Hello.
Good morning. I'm really enjoying your show here. I'm in the audio electronics repair business. I do a lot of work with recording studios. And this is another really interesting part of the business, is that a lot of the big recording studios are gone. And that's just because, my understanding is that the big labels don't have the kind of budgets that they used to do, where they spend, $100,000 or more on a record. And so a lot of these, famous big studios are gone. I even saw one for sale on eBay a couple weeks ago in Los Angeles. And what's taken the place of these big studios are the completely digital studios where, for between $5,000 and $25,000, you can arm yourself with an amazing set of digital gear, basically a Mac and some good microphones and some good, maybe a few pieces of outboard gear, and you can make an amazing record, and you can charge $25 an hour instead of $100 an hour, because some of the big studios, they've got $750,000 in their recording console, just the console itself. And so that's a really interesting sort of paradigm shift just in the recording side. So I don't know what if you have any thoughts on that at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I think paradigm shift is exactly the word for it, exactly the phrase for it. You know, it's a bad thing in general that studios are closing and people are losing their jobs, and really good, educated, experienced engineers and producers out there may be unemployed more than they were 10 years ago. But it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. I mean, on one hand, that's true, and you could argue that the expertise is gone. And we see sort of the same thing happening in the newspaper industry and other industries where, you know, there's more bloggers, there's more people with less experience doing the writing, and we're losing a lot of these really experienced journalists are taking buyouts and so forth. And, you know, I can't put a positive spin on that in any way. You know, I'm in that industry, and it's sad and it's worrisome. As far as the music industry goes, though, power to the people. You know, in the past, if you're an artist and you wanted to make a record, a big sounding record that had a chance of being a hit, you really only had one path to do that, and that was the expensive path. You had to hire a studio. You had to rent a studio and hire engineers who cost that kind of money that the caller's talking about. And now, and to do that, I should say, you also needed the backing of a record label who could float you the money. So you had to be stuck with a contract in order to do that. And now that is one way. You can still do it that way if you want, but there's also much more. There are many more resources for doing it yourself. You can use Pro Tools. You can make albums in your home. A lot of acts who are doing techno music or any kind of music really can do it themselves with much easier resources than they had in the past. And again, I think that for a lot of acts in the world who want to make records and get out there, there's more opportunity, and I think that's a positive thing.
Yeah, I agree. I have a friend who did a record on polyvinyl, and he recorded it. It's a solo record, and he did it for $1,000. He hired a local kid who's very talented, who would never have been able to have the, you know, traditional real recording studio with, you know, $300,000 worth of gear. He's got maybe $5,000 in gear and a great ear, made an unbelievable record. And so that's the great side. You get access to the world of music that, you know, really only the rich in some ways or the financially well-backed could have had in the past. So, well, thank you very much for this show. It's really fascinating.
All right, thank you. Let's go on here. We'll go to someone in Urbana. This is line 3. Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Yeah.
A couple of the other callers that I think have already touched on things that I wanted to touch on, which were like, in the old days, you'd hear Robert Plant talk about having to get his scream in before Jimmy Page came in on guitar because they were on the same track in the 8-track recording system, and these days you can do, it seems, 100 times better than they did in a studio with a Power Mac, a Creative Sound Card, and GarageBand. And I haven't read your book yet, but I wanted to ask if you had touched on things like the Gray Album and the industry's approach to intellectual property in that respect and fair use. And also just to respond to one of the other callers who talked about laser turntables, the technology still exists. The top Google link on it still has them priced at over $10,000, though.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, yeah, you know, I don't get into a lot of sort of recording technology. My book deals with mainly the record industry and its troubles and the way digital music has changed things for consumers. But certainly what you're talking about, the Gray Album, I think you're referring to the Danger Mouse album of 3 or 4 years ago when this really creative musician and producer jammed together in what they call a mashup, the Beatles' White Album and Jay-Z's The Black Album. And it was basically Jay-Z providing the vocals and the Beatles providing the backup music. And the result of it is a really cool-sounding album called the Gray Album. More recently, there's an act called Girl Talk, which is a guy who basically mixes old records and turns them into new songs. And he's put out 2 albums now, and it's all sampled music from before. He doesn't make any original. His source material is not original at all. But what he's put together, it sounds really, really good. I mean, he put out one of the best albums of last year. It's called Feed the Animals. And so this is definitely an area that people are interested in. I mean, Danger Mouse has gone on to be in the band Gnarls Barkley and is making more mainstream records that come out the traditional way. And so this is sort of a new way that artists can make music and become discovered and unlocks kind of a whole new creative thing. But yeah, there's a debate going on because they're using copyrighted music, just as the early rappers did and current rappers do when they sampled older songs. Me personally, my opinion is I think that's positive. I love sampled music. I think that people can take old samples and turn them into really interesting, creative new things.
Our guest is Steve Knopper in this hour of Focus 580. He's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. He's covered the music business since 2002. Freelancer since January of 96. He's written for publications including Wired, Esquire, Entertainment Weekly, the Chicago Tribune, and Details. He's the author of the book Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age. It's published by Free Press. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Really, as I said at the beginning, really at the heart of the book here is digital technology, and really the MP3 is the central issue here. You talked about the fact that the business, the record industry, the big companies, they actually did well for quite a few years selling CDs, but that perhaps then they didn't come to understand that there was this new emerging technology that made it possible to copy and to trade very easily songs, essentially, single tracks among people. And that's where we get to things like Napster, and then eventually we get us to the iTunes and the Apple method of distributing the music. It seems that, though, kind of at the heart of this is the fact that the companies, and understandably, they were concerned about piracy. About somebody, say, going out and buying one CD and then copying it and making 10,000 and going out and selling them on the street. But it seemed that what the record industry never really understood was that maybe there were two kinds of copying. Yes, that was something they needed to deal with, but also there were people who just wanted to, make a copy and give it to their friend. They weren't going to sell it. Now, that did mean that the business would lose money, of course, because they were losing a sale. But somehow those two things aren't the same, and yet the record industry seemed to act as if they were.
Yeah, you basically hit on my thesis in the book. I have, in my Napster chapter, I talk about how when Napster came along, which, as you say, was Sean Fanning's method of allowing people to trade these free MP3s over the internet, and it turned out to be hugely popular. When it peaked, it was something like 26 million users a month. I basically make two points in the book. One is that, you know, I believe that, yes, as the record label said, Napster and the trading of MP3s online was copyright infringement. And I'm not defending that. I'm not saying it's a good thing that people were able to basically steal music virtually over the internet. And I do believe that the record labels were right to be concerned and upset about this and even file the lawsuits that they did at the time. But what I criticize the labels for is the next thing, which is they didn't see this as a huge opportunity. They didn't see they only perceived all these millions of Napster users as thieves, bad people who just wanted free music. What they didn't see was that a lot of the people on that service liked Napster for other reasons than that it was free. It was just a good service. It was kind of a precursor to MySpace and Facebook. It was a social networking service where people could interact and talk about music in chat rooms and just get excited about music. And there's opportunities. If you make a deal with Napster at the time, there's opportunities to charge people $10, $20, $30, $50 a month for this service. There's opportunities to market music to these people because you know exactly what their tastes are. There's opportunities to sell more stuff to them, T-shirts, concert tickets, that sort of thing, maybe even put some advertising on the site. So it was a huge new business model, a giant opportunity, and instead of acknowledging that and trying to make a deal or create their own service like it, the labels just simply sued it out of existence, and that's where I think they went wrong.
Yeah, and I think, and perhaps on top of that, too, there you still have to fault the big companies for their philosophy that said, essentially, volume, volume, volume. They wanted to sell as many units as possible, and that led them to things like, giving advantages to big box stores, which was bad for small independent retailers, and also for this decision to, which you list as one of your mistakes, to get rid of the single.
Right.
And say to people, no, you want this song? You got to buy the whole CD, and because they thought, well, you know, that way, instead of selling somebody a single for a couple of dollars, they're going to sell them a CD for $16 or $17 or however much they could get for it, and that it turned out that was a big mistake.
Yes, yes. I mean, the two things that you just mentioned are full chapters called Big Music's Big Mistakes in my book. The first one, dealing with the big boxes, was that, you know, it, to an extent, it was capitalism. The labels, it was the mid-'80s, and the labels were saying, wow, we're selling a lot of these CDs. How can we sell even more? How can we sell 10 million copies of a record instead of just five? And they succeeded by making deals with Best Buy and Walmart to sell, basically, albums in bulk. And that worked for a while, but then they realized that it turned out Walmart and Best Buy and Target and so forth didn't have the same interests. They didn't necessarily have the same business model that the record labels had. The labels wanted to sell CDs. The big boxes wanted to get people into the stores with the promise of very cheap CDs so that they would buy more expensive items like a refrigerator or a computer or a dishwasher. And suddenly these stores started to deeply discount the CD prices, which was good for consumers, but it also had the effect of sort of crippling the long-established and very important record stores that were down the street from some of these stores, from Tower, which only sold music, to the mom-and-pop indie stores. And that was a large reason that retail had so many problems going forward. And then the other thing you mentioned was basically, yes, the single was basically useless to the record labels starting in, say, the mid to late 80s. And it was cheap, and people weren't buying it as often as they had, and it was too expensive to produce. So the labels basically phased it out. And then, starting in the late 90s, in the mid to late 90s, whenever you wanted to buy Who Let the Dogs Out by the Baha Men, you know, which was the big hit single that everybody was interested in at the time, you actually had to get in your car and go out to the Tower Records and spend $17 or $18 on that album. Napster came along almost precisely, coincidentally, at that time, and allowed people to cherry-pick songs from the album, and that ultimately had a very damaging effect on the industry.
Mm. Well, let's talk with some of the folks here. We'll go next to a caller in Mattoon, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, thank you very much for the show today. It's really, really interesting, and I look forward to getting a hold of this book. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. Just wanted to mention a couple of things. One, when the earlier caller was talking about the Gray album, Lawrence Lessig has done a lot of thinking and a lot of writing and a lot of talking about this sort of remixed culture and how it's really the data itself and the nature of information in our age that is making this all not only possible but inevitable, and that he sees it as really getting us back to sort of the times where people were sitting on their front porch in the evening playing their own music for each other, that we will eventually become less consumers of someone else's product and more creators of our own culture, and that we'll eventually be moving to some other model besides the traditional copyright model and mentality that we have now. So I would just recommend, his work to anybody. It's Lessig.org on the web. And then the other thing, I found it very interesting when your guest said, yeah, for music, great, this is wonderful, all of this openness and everything, but, for that blogging and that sort of thing is sort of not as good because you get all of these people that don't know what they're doing out doing it. Information wants to be free in our age. It will be free in our age. And to me, the cream rises to the top anyway. I mean, so you've got a lot of people. It's sort of like the conversation goes, well, gee, I don't really have anything to say today. Well, why don't you blog about that? and you get a lot of that. But you also get a lot of really good thought, good opinion, good content out there because people have got a way to get it out there now. I think that in some ways music is different in that what has been driving music online has been the fact that sort of radio and that sort of thing, traditional outlets for that haven't been very appealing to a lot of people for a long time, and so there was this sort of pent-up desire for, you know, being able to kind of program your own listening experience and all of that. And what drove blogging was more the desire to self-publish. But there's still, you know, it's all part of the same thing. I don't think you can say, well, yeah, you know, this openness and, you know, file sharing and all of that is really open things up for music, but it's not so good for, you know, the written word. So, yeah, just something I thought I'd mention. Yeah.
No, absolutely, and I agree with your points, but I just want to clarify my point about blogging. I mean, I think blogging is a good thing, and the fact that there are more voices out there rather than just the traditional newspaper voices, I think is very positive, just as it is in music. I was merely trying to say that the model of newspapers is similar to the model of record labels and the music industry in that it's the traditional way of putting out a newspaper is being threatened, and it's threatening the industry, and fewer and fewer people are advertising and buying newspapers. And as somebody who's in that business, that's a concern of mine. But I certainly think that the newspaper industry and the music industry's challenges are parallel in that this technology, all the way around for both industries, is a good thing and ultimately will show the way of the future for both industries. But right now, the traditional business models are really under threat, and both are going to have to figure it out pretty quick, or they're going to go down the tubes, as the caller suggests. So I'm not in any way criticizing bloggers or saying that blogging is a bad thing. I'm just saying it's bad for the business model. I guess I was just maybe more critical of that because I happen to be in the media and publishing industry and am more concerned about it. But ultimately, I think the caller is right on that point.
Okay, well, I may have kind of overstated your earlier point, but just one other quick thing. You know, I agree with you in the respect that this is the way it's going. I'm not sure that it's always a good thing, but it is the thing. I mean, this is where we're headed, and so everybody's going to have to adjust. And it may have some bad coming with it for the music industry as well, but, you know, it is definitely changing whether any of us like it or not, I think is the main thing. But thanks for your show. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for the call. We will go on here. Bloomington, Illinois is the next caller. Line 2. Hello.
How you doing today? I enjoy your show. This is a great topic. I'm 43 years old, had a brother, you know, basically grew up in the 60s, and when he came back from college, he had two big war chests of albums. So I really got into the music of, like, Stevie Wonder and Nina Simone, different, you know, artists like that where the album covers were beautiful. War album cover, where it was art form. And so what kind of upsets me about music today is that it's kind of like the death of the DJ. When I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, we used to DJ, and we had record pools, and used to go to the local, you know, ma-and-pa type store and listen to an album when it comes out. Even I remember the first Run DMC album. We'll go there on a Saturday, it'll be a release date, and they'll play their album for you, and you'll buy two copies. But what kind of saddens me now about the technology is that so much digital music, you know, you don't have DJs spinning vinyl anymore. There's only like one big company out of New York that sells has a big record pool. But even on the radio stations, you don't have the live DJ where you can call up and maybe hear something from what they used to call the B-side. And I think that's the beauty of music that one of your callers said earlier is that, you know, you used to be able to have your friends over and say, hey, did you hear, you know, song number 7 on this album? And you would play it. It didn't have to be the most popular song. And today's radio is just sickening because they play the same songs 1,000 times a day, and it's like top 10 songs. And I think that a lot of the music business, the death of it is just the repetition of the same music. You know, if it's hot, it's hot. Just because you make an album 10 years ago and it's a great song 10 years ago, why can't it be a great song now and people want to listen to? And so you have a lot of these. I think the technology is driving the creative forces of smaller corporations and smaller businesses. There's a record label called Hidden Beach, and I believe they're out of Philadelphia. And they have a lot of smaller R&B and blues stars, but they make quality music. But, you know, none of their artists will probably ever win, you know, any type of awards, but it's a quality label. And these record companies need to get back to quality music, not because it's hot, but because it's quality music. And so I really don't feel bad for the record industry losing money to the Napsters and the free downloads because they'd have made their money over years, years, and years. But start putting quality music out there and people will come back and buy it. But I think radio has a lot to do with it, is that it's actually turning us off because you get tired of the same song. Now these artists are just looking to make a ringtone or a one-hit wonder, and their career is over. They're not actually true musicians. So I think a lot has to do with the depth of the DJ.
Yeah, well, your caller makes a lot of really interesting points. Steve, do you want to comment on any of that?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that I think the caller would really enjoy internet radio. I think that his point about radio becoming more and more conservative and the playlists getting narrower and narrower over the years has been a trend that's been true for decades. I mean, we all think about the 60s as sort of the Renaissance period of free-form radio with Wolfman Jack playing, you know, whatever cuts. He'd play Frank Zappa, and then he'd play Beethoven, and then he'd play the Beatles, you know. I agree. That's sort of the ultimate what radio should be. But it wasn't very long after that, probably within a few years, that the consultants started showing up and saying, you know, let's distill all that into a music format. So that's been a trend for many, many years, and certainly it's as bad now as ever, with certain radio companies even removing the local DJ and simulcasting broadcasts from one city and sort of farming them out in sort of a syndicate all over the place. And that's a bad thing. But there are, as with everything in music, whenever you get something that gets too big and too mass and too mainstream and too boring, something pops up, whether it's in technology or whether it's in music. Just as, you know, when music was a little bit boring in the late 70s, you had punk rock, and then you had the beginning of hip-hop around that time. So it is now with technology. And if you're bored with your FM radio in your car, there's a lot of things you can do. There's Pandora, and there's MP3 blogs and internet radio and satellite radio, and there's a lot of different ways that you can get interesting music sent to you, whether you're in your office or even in your car. So, you know, I agree with the caller's point, but I guess the only way I differ is that I feel a little bit more optimistic in that, okay, maybe FM's not playing what I want, but I do have an iPod, and I can put what I want on there, you know.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank the caller. We have about 7-8 minutes left. Our guest is Steve Knopper. He is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone and is the author of the book Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age, published by Free Press. We'll talk next with someone, I believe, in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. Another fantastic program. I'm really enjoying it. I unfortunately came in the middle, but I was curious about something. I remember I'm old enough to have made the transition from vinyl to CDs, and one of the things that was interesting about that was that we were going to be able to have, you know, pristine music, you know, forever, and, you know, the LPs would wear out, or, you know, pops and so on. And in that transition, I remember reading that the cost of production might go down with the CD, and that maybe more money might go to the artists in the process. And I'm not sure that really happened economically. I wonder how much of that had something to do with some of the trends that have occurred as well.
Yeah, absolutely. As I was mentioning before, one important function that major record labels and other labels did for acts throughout the 80s and 90s and even earlier was to basically be sort of a bank. You know, labels had access to certain things that bands and artists, especially poor ones, which most of them are at first, which was they had money and they had access to expensive studios and expensive producers and directors who could make the big glossy MTV videos and a distribution chain that allowed people to get their music into the Tower Records and the Walmart and connections with radio stations and so forth. And so all these things were prohibitive. There was a barrier to entry for artists throughout this whole period. And that's still true to an extent, but with technology, the playing field is a bit more leveled now. If you want to distribute your own record, make a record cheaply using Pro Tools, distribute it on the internet using MySpace or whatever, YouTube, and then market it using these same things, MySpace and Facebook and YouTube, you can do this all yourself. You don't even need a record label. So, again, power to the people. You know, it's an excellent trend for artists. It's not so good of a trend for major record labels.
And I'd hope, too, that you know, we can see more and more artists marketing directly to people and people, you know, paying them directly for their music. And, you know, great for them to be able to, you know, make more money on their margin.
I certainly think the Radiohead and Nine Inch Nails model that we've been seeing in the last few years of basically these acts owning their own music, putting it up on the web and saying either here it is for free or pay what you want, and then later, maybe if you like us enough, buy a larger CD package or a concert ticket. I think that's a really interesting model, and I think it's a very freeing model for artists. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go next to line number 3, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you? Very interesting. And your book's very interesting. I've read it.
Thank you.
The interesting thing about this is that I've just caught the last part of the show, but it's the destruction of copyright and ownership of music. And as you said, the radio, you know, Nine Inch Nails, you know, sort of giving it away because they basically have given up on the ownership of their stuff. Now, there's something about the fact that concerts have become very important in this deal. So you're still talking about setting up a tour and everything like that. And plus the fact that you were talking about the egalitarian nature of the internet, where everyone's sort of like the field is level. Usually what that means is that the quality diminishes. Would you agree with that?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, there's definitely a signal-to-noise issue out there. If you go on MySpace, there's so many millions and billions of bands out there that it's harder to figure out which one's good, and sometimes you need a gatekeeper like a label or a radio station used to be. And I think that's still being worked out. There's bands that are emerging from this just complete limitless populism that is exact. I mean, that's a great thing for many people. And as you say, the problem is it's hard to sort of separate the wheat from the chaff, for sure.
Yeah, and it's like it turns to be the listener's problem then, because I mean, if you go on MySpace and YouTube and all these things, you basically spend, you know, how much time are you going to spend trying to filter all this stuff out? And I agree with you. I think that the record companies, and like Prince showed us through when he basically changed his name and all that stuff because he didn't even own his brand name. You know, he had these problems with all these monolithic entities, which actually are disappearing, which is actually, and you're right about that, it is probably a good thing because they also remember the producer part of this. So you're right. The producers were very important. The producers found the Dylans. And they were the people that, you know, sort of in the early business of this. And if you don't have, I think some of these artists are very good, but a lot of them, if they had any, they would say that their producer was as important as they were. So I don't know. What do you know about that? Thank you very much. I appreciate your trouble.
Sure. I mean, the producer is important. I don't really think the producer is in sort of the talent discovery part of the process, but the producer can certainly, that's the person that usually oversees the studio and the making of the music. So they can take a raw band or some raw music and make it more palatable for people to hear. I guess I would just respond to the caller by saying, yes, it is a little frustrating if you're a hardcore music fan and you want to hear everything that's good and you're frustrated with sort of top 40 and you go to MySpace and you go, well, how do I figure out what's good on here? Well, there's a little bit more exploration you have to do. I mean, it's not completely one system anymore. But, for example, there's some interesting high-tech new stuff. There's Amazon's recommendations. I go to a blog called Hype Machine, and it distills all the blogs based on what's the most popular and most of the top music blogs out there, and it kind of gives you a list of all the good music, and you can stream it. Occasionally you can download it, or at least it gives you helpful links to Amazon and iTunes. And, you know, it's hard to discover these things, and new ones pop up every day, and it can be a bit frustrating if you're really kind of an OCD music fan like I am. And so yeah, it can be troubling. The gatekeepers are, there's not just one or two gatekeepers. You can't just turn on your radio and be told sort of what the popular stuff is or read just one magazine. There's a lot more stuff, and it's a lot harder to follow, and that can be challenging. But again, you know, I keep using the word positive, but that, there's a positive aspect to that as well.
All right, another caller here, Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hi, I called earlier. I got one more quick question. Is your book available in digital download format in either audiobook or
you know, I think it's available on the Kindle.
I'm here on the Amazon site, and they say, yes, it is available as a Kindle if you got one of those things.
So, but that's you know, I'm trying to hedge that question by saying that's a decision made beyond my pay grade, to quote a phrase.
But what about PDF or AAC or MP3?
I don't believe at this point it's available on those formats, but frankly, I'm not sure. I admit to being old school in this process, so I don't have as much control over that whole thing as you'd suggest.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you. We're here to the point where we have a minute or two left. Talking about the future, I think one thing that you can say, you know, without fear of contradiction, is that in the future, more and more people will be getting more and more of their media by downloading it. That we just know that's the way that we're going. But that's not saying all that much. Do you have any sorts of thoughts about, particularly for music, what we're going to see next?
Yeah, you know, I get asked that question a lot, and I think that the model that I see emerging, as I mentioned a little bit before, is sort of this lost leader model. You know, Springsteen has an album that comes out tomorrow. This is the example I keep using. And he's given away some MP3s of his songs for free. And you say, well, why is this guy giving away his music for free? He's Bruce Springsteen. This is valuable music. Well, number one, he wants to sell more copies of his album that comes out tomorrow. Number two, even more importantly, he's most likely going to kick off a year-long tour with his halftime show at the Super Bowl on next Sunday. And then you start to say, okay, those economics make sense. I mean, maybe he won't sell as many records this way, but more people will be interested. More people will want to buy the more expensive item. And that was certainly true with Radiohead and Nine Inch Nails. And, yeah, these are big acts who have already established themselves, but I think that there are versions of that model. Give away something for free digitally online and use that to sell something else a little bit later down the road. Maybe it's a concert recording or a T-shirt or a hat or even a vinyl LP or whatever. And I think that that's something to keep in mind. I think that's a model that may work for acts. You know, whether it works for actual record labels who only sell the CD and that's the only way they really make money, you know, that's yet to be determined.
Yeah. Well, as I said, it's a really interesting book, particularly if you really are interested in getting an inside view of the record industry and learning about some of the big players. You can do that. If you're interested in the technological trends, you can do that. You can do one or the other. You can do both. There are a lot of interesting things in here for music lovers. The book is Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age, published by Free Press, by our guest, Steve Knopper. His last name spelled K-N-O-P-P-E-R, if you go looking for the book. Thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
Sure, thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for the call.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
The 2009 All-Day Agricultural Outlook Meeting is in the books. We had our second largest crowd ever in the event's 19-year history. Pay attention to the website in the next few days as we post audio from the meeting at willag.org. And thanks to these agribusinesses for helping to support this year's meeting. The Andersons, DTN, AgriGold Hybrids, ADM Investment Services, and L&M Commodities. Taking a look at the grain complex at midday, prices are beginning to turn up. Corn and soybean markets are receiving some support from bullish export sales figures that were released before the opening bell this morning, and they're rebounding from the sharp sell-off that we saw on Wednesday. It's the last trading day for March contracts as well. Corn saw about 1,092,000 tons of old crop corn sold for exports last week. In the beans, we saw about 838,000 tons and that's included 837,000 tons of old crops sold for export last week. Let's go ahead and look at the current numbers in Kansas City. March wheat now trading at 564 and a half up 7. May, 564 and three quarters up 3 3/4. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 508 up 9 1/4. May, 514 and a quarter up 6. July, 526 and a half up 6 1/4. September, 551 and a half up 6 1/2. March corn, 365 up 9. May, 372 and a quarter up 7 3/4. July, 382 and a half up 8. December, 403 and a half up 7 1/2.